The first page of The Juryman's Tale by Trevor Grove. In the spring of 1997, Stuart, Kate, Anna, Sophie, Eduardo, Keith, Magnus, Terry, Bob, Pat, Daphne, and I experienced one of the most extraordinary days of our lives. It was the culmination of 64 days of being at very close quarters with each other, from 10 every weekday morning until 4 o'clock every afternoon. Back in November the previous year, when we first encountered each other, we were a group of strangers, with very little in common other than that we were all, give or take a few miles, Londoners. 4 months later, on a Wednesday evening in March, you might have seen us drinking in a pub not far from St. Paul's Cathedral, packed tightly around a single table. You would have judged that there was something odd about the mood of the group as we exchanged telephone numbers and addresses, a kind of stunned hilarity. We must have looked like the survivors of an air crash. We were, in fact, the survivors of an ordeal not much less stressful. We were the 12 members of a newly discharged Old Bailey jury. A few hours earlier, shortly after 3 in the afternoon, we had sent the last of many penciled notes to the judge. We entered the jury box in Court 5 for the final time, with every eye in the room fixed on us and our hearts thumping. In solemn tones, the clerk of the court asked if we had reached a verdict. We had. And what was the verdict? Was it a majority, or was it the verdict of all of us? It was the verdict of all of us. Such decisions are not reached easily or lightly. We were legal amateurs, after all, a dozen very ordinary men and women, including a postman, a Heathrow cleaner, a retired schools inspector, and a Sainsbury's checkout lady. From the onset of the frosty winter of 1996 to the first days of the following spring, just as the 1997 general election was getting underway, our lives had been subjected to an immense upheaval. We had been frog-marched into a world we knew nothing of, speaking a language we sometimes barely understood, governed by regulations that made us feel we were back at school again. And when we got home from this topsy-turvy working day, we weren't even allowed to talk shop with our nearest and dearest. For week after week, we had been guided and misguided through a forest of bizarre criminal intrigue. It concerned a violent South American-style kidnap, heavy weapons, big-time gambling, blackmail, and allegations of a major police conspiracy. Our credulity was alternatively appealed to and abused. Then, after 4 months of this, we had been abruptly abandoned and ordered to resolve our confusions as best we could on our own. We were like the befuddled lovers in A Midsummer Night's Dream, after Puck had scrambled their wits and left them sleeping on the forest floor. The judge's summing up was supposed to provide signposts towards the truth, which it did, but those that might have been of most use were subtly camouflaged in the legal undergrowth. For nearly 3.5 days we had sat deliberating, 15 hours and 55 minutes to be exact. We had hundreds of hours of conflicting evidence to remember and resolve. Our jury room was submerged in sacks of ring binders, documents in tottering heaps. There had been some 80 witnesses, a police video, scores of tape recordings, and 103 exhibits. They included a gun, an array of hypodermic syringes, a pair of handcuffs, and a sinister-looking leather mask with a zip across its mouth. Sheer weight of evidence, whatever its quality, can bamboozle the clearest of minds. Yet somehow we had found a road through the woods, and now, under the gaze of the whole court, the black-robed judge, the barristers in their horsehair wigs, the ashen-faced prisoners, the police, prison officers, the press, we had delivered our conclusion.